Welcome to City Hope London's Sermon Podcast. To find out more about us, visit www.cityhope.london.
For those of you who don't know me, hi, morning, my name's Rebecca. I'm your preacher today. And if you've not been around for the last few weeks, you won't know that we've been in a sermon series in the book of Judges. Most of you will know that and will have heard some great sermons in the last few weeks. If you missed any, they're all on our website if you want to catch up in that way. So one of the things we've noticed, I think, as we've gone through the book of Judges, and we haven't finished, by the way, is very often we're looking for a good guy or a good woman to solve a problem. And what we find in the book of Judges is that very often the good guys are also the bad guys. It's a bit like the series we did last summer, if you remember, the goodish kings. Even the good guys weren't that good. And that's why we called this the goodish judges, although that's really a stretch because there's really not many good ones. But they're really flawed. You know, even the ones who come to the rescue are very flawed. They're weak. They're often actually idolatrous. They're not really heroes at all. In the book of Judges, there's this awful cycle that goes round and round. That's one of the things we tried to bring out in the series. And if you're reading the book at home yourself or in your connect groups, you'll see this sort of cycle of destruction and doom, of real sort of rebellion and unrighteousness. And then the people get desperate and cry out, and then God sends a redeemer or a rescuer. But it's this repetitious nightmare. It just doesn't seem to get any better. We get this episode, you know, it says there was peace for this many years, but then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And you know, even the way that the book is arranged is telling us that very thing. So as you probably know, back in Genesis, there's an expectation announced that the rescuer, the great redeemer, will one day come from the line of the tribe of Judah. Okay, but the book of Judges begins with a judge called Othniel, who we didn't actually look at because he only gets a few lines. But he's from Judah and he's a pretty good guy. But then the rest of the book, every judge that we hear about comes from a tribe further and further away from Judah. It's almost like the author of the book is trying to tell us not only is there a kind of repeating pattern of sin and despair, it's actually getting worse. There's actually a kind of downward spiral that's getting further and further away from God's purposes. And it's like we're watching this and sort of thinking, what's going to happen next? Until we get to the end of the book of Judges, where there's this awful, gruesome story of sexual assault and murder, which leads to a civil war amongst the tribes of Israel. It's so distressing. It's like a car crash you can't look away from, the book of Judges. So you might say, well, why are we looking at Ruth? Because Ruth's a different book of the Bible. It's not in the book of Judges. And we thought you could do with a break. That's not the only reason. But the book of Ruth, if you like, is a bit like an antidote. It's a bit like an antitoxin to the book of Judges. And so it fits in the right sort of time. I'll explain that in a minute. And so we've got to get to breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief today because there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We haven't finished with the book of Judges, so next week we're here, we're not looking at Judges next week, then we're in the park the following week, we come back in September and we'll carry on for a little bit with the book of Judges. But the book of Ruth, so, begins with the words, in the time of the Judges. Okay, so it's set in that time, that's why we've included it. And many of you, I'm sure, know it. In fact, lots of people say, oh, that's a bit of a favourite of mine, or I suspect you've heard lots of sermons on it. Some of you won't be familiar, and we're going to try and make sure you don't miss anything. But we're going to try and look at it in light of the Judges. So it's a slightly different approach today to the story of Ruth. And it is a story. It's a great story. It's a really great story. It's four chapters long. I'm not going to read the whole thing, you'd be glad to know, because I know for some of you I'd have lost you immediately if we try and read a whole book of the Bible. So what I am going to try and do is tell the story as clearly and succinctly as I can before we get in and find some things. Is that okay? So gather in, listen, because I'm going to tell you the story. So the story relates to a woman called Naomi, and she's married to a guy called Elimelech, which is quite hard to say. Can I call him Eli, so I don't have to keep wrapping my tongue around that? Okay. So she's married to Eli. They live in Bethlehem, which is a very familiar, important place in the Bible story. And it's the time of the judges. And because we know in the time of the judges, Israel is constantly rebelling, you know, and they're constantly being subject to their enemies or to disaster in the land. Maybe that's why we discover at the beginning of this story there's a famine in the land. And so Naomi and Eli decide to move because there's not enough resources to go around. And so they take their two sons and they move to find somewhere that's safer and there's actually enough food. So they end up living in a place called Moab. And they live there for some time and their boys grow up. And in fact, their boys get to marrying age and they both get married in Moab. And so life is trundling along quite nicely and there's enough food and so life goes on. But not for long. There's a sting in the tail and very sadly for Naomi, who becomes one of the heroes of our tale, her husband dies. So she, if we can just think through for her in her context what that means, she's a refugee, she's fled her home, she's had to relocate because of crisis, she's a stranger in the land, and now she loses her husband. In her culture and in her context, that's a big deal because he's her protector, provider, he's the head of the household, very important figure. But, of course, she's got two sons, so all is not lost. She's got these two married sons, and so the family grieve together and they move on. And then in an unbelievable turn of events for this poor woman, one by one, both her sons die. So both the grown-up sons die. So Naomi then is left in this land, this strange land of Moab, with these two daughters-in-law. And again, we must understand in the context, there's no man to provide for them or protect them. It's a pretty dire situation. And also what you need to know, place and family are so important in the Bible stories, okay? So important in that part of the world and in that time. And here they are. Here Naomi is. She's in a place that's not home, and she's got no people there. Her family are back in Israel, obviously. So she's got these two Moabite daughters-in-law, and they're stuck. Now, the other complication is that Moab is an enemy of Israel. So traditionally, there's huge animosity between Moab and Israel. They're not friends, okay? So it was an interesting choice of somewhere to settle in the first place. They've obviously made it work, but they're not friends. Moab and Israel, there's a lot of history. You can go and do the research about that yourself. I don't have time to go into that. So what is Naomi going to do? Well, she resolves to go home, which you can understand, right? She wants to go home. So she heads back to Bethlehem, a walk of about 50 miles, carrying a few possessions, I guess. So she returns home. But of course, when she gets home, she's going to be a returning refugee, very much alone, still in a pretty dire situation without her husband. And she would have been completely alone, apart from the fact that one of her daughters-in-law, Ruth, insists on accompanying her. And this is a pretty rogue decision for Ruth, okay? This is not what you would do. I think it was what I would do. Firstly, of course, she's a Moabite. We know that. She's going to go to Bethlehem, where she's, you know, she's part of a people that are not liked. So Naomi says to her, don't. No, you don't have to come. You stay in Moab. You've got the chance of marrying again. You've got a chance of making a life for yourself again. Don't come with me. And this is what Ruth says in a very familiar text. She says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. Even when Naomi dies, as she will, Ruth says, I'm going to stay. I'm going to become part of your family. She's utterly dedicated to serving her mother-in-law. But when they get back to Bethlehem, obviously they've got nothing, but it's harvest time, which is a great reminder that the famine has passed and that Bethlehem in Hebrew means house of bread, actually. So it's a house of bread. Bethlehem in the Bible is often a place of real hospitality and provision for others. And of course, it's where the bread of life himself was born. And when they get there, it's harvest time. And as you can read in Leviticus, actually, there's a law in the Old Testament law of Moses that said when you harvest your field, if you're a farmer, when you harvest, you're not to harvest to the edges and you're not to pick up all the grain that falls to the ground. You're to leave that. In fact, it says Leave them for the poor and the foreigner, the Lord says in the Mosaic law. So there's an opportunity, and what Ruth does is she humbly takes on this job of going and what's called gleaning in somebody else's field, basically picking up whatever's left by the harvesters. And so she goes to do that to provide for herself and Naomi. And do you know what? She ends up gleaning in the field of a guy who happens to be a relative of Eli, her dead father-in-law. Okay, this is Boaz. Enter Boaz. Good name, hey? I'm surprised not more people call their baby boys Boaz. Because as you're going to see, he's a great guy. And people like to pick some good Old Testament names for their kids, don't they? Yeah, we've got Joel. That's a good Old Testament prophet. Good name. We're so good at that era. Lots of people in the church were having babies. We're like, we've got to get Joel. Let's hope no one else picks the name. You'll go for Boaz next. John and Jackie's next boy is going to be Boaz. Okay. Yes, so Naomi and Ruth. Yeah, very good. Yeah, Boaz. There you go. A little bit of something for you to think about. So the other thing you need to know about the Old Testament law is that there's this tradition and law which says that in the context we're talking about, when a man dies and his wife is childless, she's left in a pretty vulnerable situation. And so what then has to happen is the dead man's brother has to take her in and marry her. Okay, that's called levirate marriage. It was a provision within the Old Testament people of God in order that when a dead man has left no heir, the brother comes along, provides an heir, so provides children for this widow who now becomes his wife, and that first child will become the heir of the dead man. So it's a very sacrificial thing to do, actually. You take her in and marry her in order to provide an heir for your dead brother so that his name will not be lost and so that someone will inherit his land. Okay, that's the tradition. It's called levirate marriage. Now, the trouble is, of course, Ruth's husband died, but so is his brother. So that's not going to happen. So she's in a really tricky situation. There's a possibility that someone else in the family might step in and take that responsibility, but of course it's a big risk, and she's a Moabite. But Boaz turns out not just to be Eli's kinsman, family member, but he also turns out to be a wealthy landowner, turns out to be a very respected guy in the town, and a thoroughly decent chap as well. So he gives Ruth more than she can gather in the field. He gives her extra. He tells her, don't go gleaning in other fields where you might be at risk, where it might not be safe. Stay in my fields. When my workers go to another field, you stick with them. I've told them to make sure you're safe. I've told them to look out for you. He'll make sure she isn't harmed. Are you still with me?
Yeah.
Okay, then in chapter 3, it takes a slightly weird turn with a what looks like a bit of a sketchy situation, which is that Naomi advises Ruth, and you've got to realize this is in a very different time and place from ours, to go along at night to where Boaz is sleeping. And she's to go along. Basically, this is the advice. He's going to have had his dinner. He's probably had a couple of glasses of wine. So he's going to be sleeping the sleep of a well-fed older man. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Complete with snoring, I suspect. Mentioning no names.
It's not me.
Well, he doesn't snore, to be fair, so. So Boaz is on the threshing floor, which you might think is a funny place to sleep, but hey. So the threshing floor is like a big stone circle where you thresh the grain to get the grain separated from the straw. Often in the Bible, actually, significant things happen on threshing floors. Angels appear and all sorts of things happen. But here, he's just had his dinner and he's sleeping. I don't know if he's been working late and it's like sleeping at the office because you've been working late, or if he's guarding the crop or what, I don't know, but he's there. And she is told to go there while he's sleeping to uncover his feet and to lie down at his feet. Now, some people have suggested that this is, she's trying to seduce him. I just want to put paid to that idea, because some of you might have read it when you've heard about Ruth. There's nothing at all in the text that suggests that's what's going on. In fact, Naomi and Ruth throughout the whole book are just portrayed as righteous, upright, and full of integrity. So we'll put paid to that idea. But what happens, of course, is he wakes up at midnight and is slightly surprised to find this young woman lying at his feet. And he says, it's dark. So he's like, who are you? And she says, I'm Ruth. I'm Naomi's daughter. And I've come to ask you for help. In fact, verse 9 of chapter 3 says this. I am Ruth, your servant, she replied. Take me under your wing, for you are our family's redeemer. And that take me under your wing phrase, it's almost metaphorical. She's sort of saying, spread your cloak over me. In other words, protect me. You know, would you perform this duty of taking me in and protecting me, or of spreading your wings over me, which is a really nice picture. And he responds with absolute integrity. He sends her away with lots of food, sends her away in the early morning so it's dark and no one will get the wrong idea. He calls her honourable. He commends her for her faithfulness to Naomi. And he actually then reveals a bit of a spanner in the works, which is there's another guy in town who's closer relative to Eli, so he should be the one who's the family redeemer. He should get first dibs, as it were. Because not only is there Ruth to look after, there's land. So there's her husband's rightful inheritance of land in Bethlehem. So there's a guy who says, well, actually, there's another guy. He should get the opportunity to buy the land, to have it joined to, you know, his responsibility. But then he has to take in Ruth as well. And the guy's interested in the land, but he's not interested in Ruth, it turns out. So it falls to Boaz. And it turns out that Boaz is every bit the hero we need in the story. He marries Ruth. She has a son. What the Bible actually says is it's Naomi's son, because Naomi's the one who's been left without husband and without sons. Let's read this. Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." And Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him, and the women living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So much as it looks like it, this is not just a wholesome tale with a happy ending. It is one of those, which is a bit of a light relief after the book of Judges, but it's so much more. And as I said at the beginning, it's like the antidote to Judges. You know, in Judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That phrase just keeps coming up and up again. There's lawlessness, there's war, there's rebellion, there's scheming. And in the book of Ruth, there's just like, there's no baddies. A bit odd, isn't it? It's a story, but no baddies in it. But that's what it is. And even the ones, people who've really suffered and maybe... you know, there's temptation to do things in a different way. They behave with integrity and dignity. Naomi, I think, is certainly reminiscent to me of Job, who we call the righteous sufferer. Remember him who lost everything but refused to blame God or curse God? And Ruth, of course, just gives up everything to go with her mother-in-law. There's nothing in it for her. There really is nothing in it for her, as far as she knows, this idea of going back with her and helping and serving her mother-in-law. And Boaz, of course, is the hero that we're longing for all the way through the book of Judges, and we never really get to. Apart from, of course, Deborah. Deborah's a bit of a good one. Mick got to do that. He was lucky. But I just want to bring out, if it's all right, I want to bring out a little thread, which is interesting and I think helps us engage with this story in a different way. So back in the family history of both Boaz and Ruth, there's a very shady encounter. You could say it's a bit like a distortion of the Levirate marriage thing I talked about, okay? In Boaz's family, back in his family, there's an episode with someone called Tamar. She's married to a guy who dies, and they have no children. So the brother steps in, takes her in, and he dies, and there's no children. The Bible actually tells us that they're both evil in God's eyes, and he takes them out. But the father of these men is Judah, okay, the son of Israel, the one who is, as I've already said, the one who's prophesied to be the tribe from which the Messiah will come, Judah. So Judah's father of these two sons. But what happens to Tamar is she's now lost two husbands, and Judah, we read, basically doesn't want to do the right thing by her. He wants to cheat her out of her rights. So what Tamar does is she takes matters into her own hands. She actually dresses up as a prostitute. And she entraps Judah, who who sleeps with her. She conceives, and then she tells Judah what she's done, who she is. And at the end of the story, Judah says, she's more righteous than I am. She's more right than I am. She's done what is right, and I have not. You got all sorts of questions about that, I know, but bear with me. So out of that encounter, we get Perez, who's in the family line of Boaz. Just another little aside, just a freebie for you, is that Boaz is also the son, or maybe the grandson, of Rahab. Remember Rahab? She's the Canaanite woman who houses the spies in Jericho. She turns to the Lord. She joins the people of God by marrying a guy called Salmon. She's the genealogy says she's the mother. Whether that means literal mother or grandmother, we don't know, because genealogies miss out generations. But that's Boaz's history. And what about Ruth? Well, as I've said, Ruth is a Moabite. And when you read the book of Ruth, as you will this afternoon or tomorrow or whatever, it'll take you like 10 or 15 minutes, really, the whole thing. You see that the writer just keeps reminding you, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite. It's like as if you could forget who she is, okay? Well, she's the product of a horrendous situation, a very shady situation, where back in Genesis, when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, and Lot, who's Abraham's nephew, flees with his daughters. His daughters are worried they're not going to find men to a husband. So they get their father drunk and they sleep with him to produce children. Horrendous. And one of those children then becomes the father of the tribe, the people of Moab. That's where she comes from, okay? So there's two awful stories of people taking matters into their own hands to perpetuate their line, Tamar and Lot's daughters. And when Ruth goes to Boaz at night to that threshing floor in that situation, we're supposed to go, oh no, history's going to repeat itself. This is Ruth's lot is going to be disgrace. It's going to be compromised. You know, she takes herself to this guy. She barely knows him. She risks everything. She goes at night. But Boaz, this is what we're supposed to see in the book of Ruth. Boaz breaks the chain. He breaks that generational chain with the past. He's honorable, he's generous, and he calls her a woman of valor. If you've read the book of Proverbs, which is all about wisdom, right at the end, there's this beautiful acrostic poem about the personification of wisdom, and she's a woman, and she's called a woman of valor. That Hebrew term is applied by Boaz to Ruth. It's the only person in the Bible who's given that epithet is Ruth. She's a woman of valor. And she asks him, will you spread your wings over me? Will you protect and provide? What does he do? He sends her home with dignity. Then he marries her. This guy's already going to have a family, right? So he's taking on extra. He's doing something entirely selfless to act as what the Bible calls a kinsman redeemer or a guardian redeemer. We sang about the great redeemer this morning, didn't we? My redeemer lives. And this cycle of sin and shame and rebellion is broken. It makes you go, oh, doesn't it? After all the darkness of Judges. And at the end of the book, we read, the son born to Ruth will go on to be the grandfather of King David. We'll just read the genealogy. I don't know how you get on with genealogies in the Bible, whether you just skip them. Some of them are really long. But this one's exciting. This then is the family line of Perez. Remember, Perez came from Tamar and Judah. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Aminadab, Aminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon, who was the one who married Rahab, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David. The answer to the book of Judges, of course, is the kingdom of David, which will come, the monarchy which comes, and from whose line the Messiah will come. Do you know the very first thing you read at the beginning of the New Testament is what? It's a genealogy. The beginning of Matthew's gospel, there's the genealogy of Jesus. They love their genealogies, okay, these people. I'm guessing, unless you're really into that thing, what's it called? Who do you think you are? Unless you're really into things like that, I guess genealogies are a bit meh to us, but to them, they're so important. And we read right at the beginning of the New Testament, there's Jesus' family line, and it includes Judah, and it includes King David, but it also includes Rahab and Tamar and Ruth. These women, some of them complete outsiders to Israel, and they're all there in this list of ascendants of the Christ, of God's Messiah, by being faithful, brave, by being used by God And as I said, this is a wonderful contrast to the book of Judges. You've got honour being given and received. You've got covenant being upheld. You've got outsiders coming in and playing this extraordinary role. And then you've got this like Christ-like figure of Boaz. Judges is a dark era of Israel's story. But with Ruth, we see this kind of light coming through that God is at work. I've lost my... Here we go. And the exciting thing, this sort of thing excites me really, is like Ruth is just doing what's in front of her. Yeah, she's doing what's in front of her. She's being faithful. She's being full of integrity. And what happens is she ends up being recorded in God's salvation history forever. Isn't that amazing? We might not end up, you know, we won't end up listed in the Bible because it's... The canon is closed. Announcement. But don't we want to be involved and listed in God's salvific history, in his plan of salvation for the world? There's this lovely, rich vein of gospel truth running through this story. So when we've got these two refugee women arrive at Bethlehem and it's harvest time and they happen to end up in Boaz's field, and he says, don't go anywhere else, just stay close, you'll be safe, I'll protect you, I'll provide you. It's what the Old Testament and the New Testament would call patronage. He's like saying, I'll be your patron. I'll look after you. I'll provide for you, even though you don't bring anything to the table. It's a picture of Jesus for us, isn't it? He says, just stay in my field. Stay close. I'll protect you. You won't be harmed. After harvest, of course, Ruth needs an ongoing plan because the harvest doesn't last forever. She can't glean forever. She takes this huge risk. Will she be rejected? And of course, she's foreign. One of the worst kinds of foreigners. She's widowed. She's poor. Boaz is important. He's wealthy. He can't marry someone like her, can he? She risks everything. She dresses up. She goes at night in this weird scenario and says, please, would you spread your wings? And what he does is such a picture of Jesus. Because you knew I was going to get to Jesus in the end, didn't you? Is his status is compromised so that hers can be elevated. Such a great picture, isn't it? He absorbs the shame of who she is and he gives her honour. She becomes the wife of Boaz. And she, in fact, has a son and provides for Naomi this lineage that is so, so important. Again, the lineage that would lead to King David and finally to Jesus. Ruth's story is like our story, really. Isn't it? Lost, alone, without a real plan, a bit hopeless. Where will we get protection? Where will we find security? And Jesus is like that kinsman redeemer, our redeemer who lives forever. He spreads his wings and our hope is restored. That's what he does for us, isn't it? So, I mean, it's a bit like a fairy story, this really, isn't it? And what it doesn't tell us is that when we follow Jesus, when we are joined to the family of God, we have a fairy tale ending in everything. We find our prince, we find our Boaz, or whatever it is that we're looking for in life. I don't think that's the moral of the tale. But one of the things I think it does say is that God delays sometimes, but he's never late. Remember last week, if you were here last week, Bongai was talking about Abimelech, and he said there's this question, it's like, why does God let this continue? Why does God let this self-seeking, like nightmare of a ruler continue for all these years? Why is he not intervening? And people are thinking, where's God? Why is he not doing this? And sometimes we just have to be patient and know that his timing is better, know that his knowledge is so far above ours. But what we can say is, like, look at this story, right? And that's time of the judges, which looks so dark. And when you read through the book of Judges, it's so depressing. Is that in the time of the judges, this story was happening. This thing is happening. That God is at work. That you know, it's never as lost as it looks. God can be God can delay, but he is never late. He carries out his purposes, as Bongai said last week, in his way and in his time. And as he did so in this story, we see him pulling into the story all these people that no one else would choose to do that. He takes this Moabite, and it's almost like, I remember Andy McCulloch, many of you know Andy, once saying it, when you read the story of Ruth, every time you read Ruth the Moabite, you're supposed to go boo, like it's like almost like a pantomime boo every time you hear the word Moabite. You know, it's that feeling. She shouldn't be there, should she? Should she be in there? Rahab, the Jericho prostitute who protected the Israelite spies, she doesn't seem like the sort of person who would be in the genealogy of the Jewish Messiah. Tamar, used and abused and cheated by the men who were meant to protect and provide for her. She has to be the hero in her own story. You can go back and read that in Genesis 38, I think. Should these women be there in this lineage? And the answer, of course, is yes, they should. Because the whole story of the Bible, as we know, is that God's plan is to use a people to bless all people. Yes, to choose a people through whom the earth could know and belong to God. This is a quote from, I've put Schreiner because I'm not sure which Schreiner, I think it's probably Thomas. But surprisingly, Ruth forms a link in the chain that would bring David into the world, solving the problem of judges where Israel lacked a king. And a future son of David would bring many more Ruths, many more Gentiles into the fold of God's people and fulfill the promise of universal blessing made to Abraham. I don't know how many times I preach sermons on different parts of the Bible and I always come back to the Abrahamic blessing. I will bless you to make you a blessing, God says. And that's the story. That's our story. I will bless you to make you a blessing. And the story of Ruth gives us this wonderful picture of that Messiah, that Redeemer who spreads his wings over us like a protective mother hen over her chicks, who takes the shame and the sin of humans and exchanges it for his honor. Ruth, you know, she had nothing to offer. Boaz had everything she needed. Just like Christ takes our disgrace and our sin, he takes outsiders, he takes people who don't feel like they should belong. If you feel like you belong or you don't feel like you belong, you can only belong in Christ to God. But he gives us hope, security, protection. And all of that is not in the kind of fairy tale, everything's going to be fine, because the Bible's very clear that that's not how life is lived as a Christian, in the here and now. But all of those promises of protection and redemption and security are eternal ones. They're forever, and they're all Jesus's to give. They're all his to give. And despite this kind of cyclical disappointment of the judges, there's this light shining through it all of the plan of salvation for all nations that would come through the line of Judah, this son of David. And as Isaiah himself prophesies, it's too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. And here we are, 21st century London, and all over the world, the salvation promise, the light in the darkness has shone, that offer of redemption, of spreading his wings over us to protect us, to give us hope and security, has extended and is still extending to all the nations of the world. Isn't that amazing? And as we finish, and the band are just going to come up, we've got a little bit of time to worship again, worship Jesus, the Son of God, worship the Father, expect to meet him by his Spirit, because he's so good. Every page of this book that we read, we see his goodness, we see his plans coming through the history. Anyway, so at the end of this series, or towards the end of the series, we've got this event on the 3rd of September, and it's just another plug for this, really. So there are some stories in Judges, I alluded to the one at the end earlier of the concubine. It's a horrendous story, and some people read it and think, I don't know what to do with that. There's also the questions of things like Israelite violence towards other nations and those kind of things. They're big ethical questions that we need to, when we read the Bible, we can't just gloss over, we need to engage with those. So we've got an evening on the 3rd of September, 8 o'clock here. We're just going to attempt to address some of those questions and have a bit of a Q&A. So if that's of interest to you, please do come along. Bongai, myself, and Charlotte will be speaking, and then there'll be time for questions. Is that okay? Yes. But Now let's just return to Jesus, our Redeemer, the one who has rescued and redeemed us. Every next time you read Ruth, in fact, I do recommend you go away and read it soon after what you've heard, because it's very short and a great story, but hopefully you'll just see so much of the richness of God's plan through it. It's amazing. But in the meantime, I hand over to Rach, who's going to lead us in some more worship. Thanks, Rach.